Hey everybody, it is your favorite boy, Drewy here. Just spruiking the pod, spruiking the Patreon as we do. Jump over to patreon.com/communitynoticeboard. We've got deep dives, we've got news off cuts, we've got oral history of Sydney comedy, we've got just great eps, a lot of fun. So jump over there, sling us $5 and love ya.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Community Notice Board, a podcast about suburbs we grew up in, local landmarks, and hometown heroes. Oh, baby, you asked for it. You get it. We're riding solo. We're continuing the underbelly.
It's your fault.
You were talking to Alex then.
You asked for it.
You get it.
We're continuing the Under Bensley series. Ooh. We're doing...
Not much under here.
I've seen a couple of matchsticks in my time.
Matchsticks, a bee's dick.
What else can fit on? A bee's dick? Yeah. That's good. I don't mind that. How big is a bee's dick?
That's the expression. It's like, you know, smaller than a Bensley's dick.
Yeah, is that an actual expression, smaller than a bee's dick?
Yeah.
I've never heard
that's
that.
That's what the bee stands for.
Is that like an Australian idiom?
It must be, right? Yeah. I don't know.
I definitely remember like my mate trying to teach like Americans Australian idioms, and afterwards I was like, I have never heard that. And he was like, I just made it up.
Yeah.
I just wanted to hear them say it. He was saying like, four clicks of a duck's asshole is 4 kilometers. Yeah, and I was like, I've not heard that before
Every single listicle is like the 10 phrases Americans are don't understand where they come to. I was like, no one would ever say any of this nonsense. Yeah, it's just all like.
You don't hear very much anymore. You don't hear Americans referred to as seppos, like general colloquial.
You see it online, I think. It seems
that's
to
That's one
be
of those things where I only ever hear it when it's like a reference to this is what we got. Like, it's never used in just normal conversation.
Yeah.
It's always used as a reference to.
And like, if I had to explain seppo, the only thing I'd have is Mike Goldstein's bit about what being a seppo means. But anyway, Under Bensley.
Yeah, baby.
Where are we going?
We're doing true crimes. We are going to the west of Australia, specifically Western Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And we are
to be more specific, WA.
West of Australia, to be more specific, Mumbai.
Flying to Perth.
Yeah, we're flying to Perth. We're getting that 5 hours. We're Community Notice Board. We got a Patreon now. We're flying first class. At least Al is, while me and Drew are in coach. He sends down a couple of mimosas to us.
Did I tell you? I think I told you, Jeremy, but did I tell you, Al, about my taxi ride to the airport when I went the other week for work?
I think maybe. I don't know. Come on, tell us.
Most insane taxi drive I've ever had.
Because you did something stupid?
This guy was psychotic. I jump in and it was a silver service taxi, but it was like...
Just imagine Drew dropping a glass in the back seat going, taxi!
Uber!
I ordered it on the app and it sends the next car, right? I didn't select it, but I jump in and he could obviously see that I didn't specifically select silver service. So he starts going, mate, you've got to always make sure you order the silver service. It's the best, only the most experienced taxis. You need to be a taxi driver for 10 years to be silver service. No complaints. That's 10 years. No complaints. He's going off, like, not even taking a breath.
I didn't even know that.
And I'm going, oh, man, cool. Like, yeah, great to know.
It was
like,
just you needed to own a silver car.
Yeah. And then he's saying, you know, it's set price. They're never going to gouge all this stuff. And I'm going, yeah, thanks, man. What a great tip. And he starts going on about, yeah, I've never had any complaints. And then he starts talking about, this was the first red flag. He's like, I'm a great driver, no complaints. And then he goes, oh, you know, I almost lost my license from points because I just got 3 tickets in 1 month.
That's not great driving.
And I was like, oh, that's weird. And he's like, yeah, it's the points that get you. I don't care about the cost. It's the bloody points that get you because I've got to drive. And he starts complaining about the police being sneaky. You know, he's doing an illegal U-turn, so he's at fault, but it's 4 a.m., right? There's no one around. Sure. And he's like, and these fucking bastards, they're always there. And he starts getting more heated. And then we pull up, like, just near sort of, as you're going into Mascot, there's like a weird turn thing. And a lady beeped him and cut around him because he kind of got stuck at the corner. And when she beeped him, he pulls out into, like, so there's 2 lanes going forward, 2 lanes going right, and he wanted to go forward, and she was in the last lane going forward. So he pulls into the lane turning right, stops up, like super far from the traffic light, backing up traffic, winds his window down and just starts fucking unleashing on this woman. And let me tell you, I won't repeat them, but there were some racial slurs getting hurled.
Oh, no. And it's,
to hear him in the wild, it freaks you out. Yeah. You're like, oh, my God, people still talk like this.
Is there a gold service? Where
mate, you got to drive a gold car.
But then the best part, he was like screaming, and then he speeds off down. So he's in the lane where he has to turn right, but he just like waits for the light to turn green, fucking Fast and the Furious across the lane, Pulls in. And the whole time he's going, fucking this, if that was a man, I tell you what, she's lucky she's a woman. If that was a man, I would have reached in there and fucking pulled her out and beat the shit out of her. And God. But at between this, he's trying to still maintain this silver surfer. So he kept going, he kept being like, and you know, I'm a calm guy. You know, I'm one of the most calm guys, but this motherfucker, and I'm calm, all right? Like I'm a chill guy, and that's, and it was fuck, I was dying like Texan Hannah the whole time. Like, if I don't make it.
Oh, the only reason I didn't kill this person is because she was a woman.
Yeah.
Oh, so I settled for yelling racial slurs at her and threatening her in the lane next but to her, also, which I did not belong in, by the way.
Hey, no complaints. 10 years, no I couldn't believe that.
How's like, he got no complaints?
That's the first thing I thought.
Still no complaints. An Uber to Drew Everly. Didn't complain, that's for sure.
Remember taking an Uber to Everly one time, and the guy was like, I hopped in Marrickville, and the guy's like, you got lucky. And I was like, oh, what's that? Is this guy going to suck my dick? And he was like, I am the best driver in the world. And takes off. And he's like, you know, And I was like, what makes you the best driver? And he's like, I'll show you. And then gets out his phone and he has a YouTube channel And starts showing me videos.
Already
but like just
driving.
In his hand. And I was just like, yeah, I'm in there being like, but man, you're watching a phone right now. Yeah. And he was like, that's how good I am. And I was like, okay, cool, man. And to be fair,
I'm drunk too, man.
Yeah, he did a very punk rock U-turn, but while watching a YouTube video about him doing U-turns.
Oh, man, that's pretty meta.
And did he film that one as well? It's like an episode of Community.
He's going to show that film to the next guy. Like, watch this, I'm watching.
But I remember, like, at the end, he was like, because, you know, like, I'm not sure how much it happens now, but like back in the first days of Uber, like everyone, like you would be getting out and they'd like almost grab your arm and be like,
five stars.
Five stars?
Yeah,
guy was like, I don't want just five stars. Like he's like, I want like a recommendation and a tip. And I was like, you can't ask. Yeah. But that U-turn was so punk rock, I gave him the $2.
You gave him $2.
Well, it was a $14 drive.
Damn. Jesus Christ.
Anyway. Perth True Crime. I'll start off because I got something that's quite fun. It's called the Perth Mint Swindle.
Ooh, it sounds delicious.
Yeah, after dinner?
Yeah,
I'm ready.
I was just looking up recipes of after AIDS, and then this came up, and then it was a story about gold, and I was like, fuck, you can't eat
come
this.
On.
They look like big bars of
Wait,
chocolate.
Jamie, gold can buy you many, many.
By a big Toblerone with that gold money. But so this is from ABC News, and it says there are a few bigger scandals in WA history than the 1982 Perth Mint Swindle. Its cast of memorable characters included a trio of larrikin brothers, which I love, a corrupt detective, which we love, who is ultimately murdered in a bikey revenge car bombing, and tangentially, the infamous businessman who we've mentioned on this pod before, Alan Bond. The story began with the audacious theft from the Mint of 68 kilograms of gold. So that's
a shitload.
That's like a Drew Bensley worth of gold.
Well, I mean,
what year
if I stack
this?
A couple of kgs. What year?
1982.
Have you guys ever been to the Mint in Canberra?
No.
I've got a great scam going where you press your own dollar coin.
You
at
ever
least
been
last
to
time
the
I was there.
Spear Mint Rhino?
Yeah, many times. But you pay $2 to make yourself $1.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's one of the greatest. That's the great mint swindle.
Would you win a feature or something? It's just like literally a poking machine.
Yep. So
68 kg of gold.
68 kg of gold. In a manner that seems incredible by today's security standards, on June 22, the Mint received phone calls from three men who ordered the gold, one who identified himself as Bob Fryer, another as Mr. York, and the third a Mr. Blackwood. So this gold was worth $653,000 at the time, which equates to about $6.4 million today.
Okay, right, yeah.
The gold, it was 49 bars worth of gold, so 49 to 60 kilograms.
But so private citizens calling up and ordering gold, that's how it works?
I think you could just do that. That's, be like, man, so
that's the biggest red flag ever. Yeah. Is there any real reason for
I'm
that?
A gold guy. We have a podcast called Community Notice Board. We got a Patreon. We can afford gold now.
We haven't checked our accountant, but this seems like a good idea.
We haven't checked our Patreon numbers in a while either. The gold in the form of 49 bars was collected from the mint by three guards who turned up in separate armored vehicles. So three separate vehicles with the gold in it. Each presented a building society check to the mint for the precious metal, which were accepted. So the three guys, they gave a check, and so the checks were accepted.
Can't be how they did.
And the gold bullion was handed over.
On a check.
Yeah.
That's fucking insane. Wow, it was an IOU or something. Like, this is unbelievable.
Amazing. So it's just a piece of paper being like, I'm good for it. After that, it wasn't until the following day that it was discovered that the checks had been stolen and the money did not exist. With few apparent leads and public pressure mounting, police began to get desperate as the days and then weeks elapsed without an arrest. And then, out of the blue, a stunning confession from a young Perth abalone diver. Did you know abalone?
Mm.
It's a disgusting fucking fish thing.
I didn't know it was disgusting.
I've never eaten it.
It sells for a lot of money. Yeah. And it's like, there are places in Chinatown that do it where it's like, it's in like gift boxes.
Mm.
And it's, because I remember I used to work with a Japanese guy named Toru, and he was like, he would take me to places, and that like a lot of them were awesome. He was like, now we're going to go look at the abalone shops. And I was like, what's so cool about abalone? He's like, it's like this big, like the size of a 50-cent coin, and it's so expensive. And you go in there, and it stinks.
Is it like a, you know, like a crustacean, a clammy
like
type thing?
I think it's kind of like oyster scallopy. So anyway, a Perth abalone diver, he confessed, and then he implicated two of his brothers in the crime as well. So police celebrated, and it's a fairly safe bet.
All our hard work. Nothing, and a guy called up.
Yeah, the SVU theme players as they do that. Police celebrated, and it's a fairly safe bet. Sighs of relief were heard all the way down Hay Street, from State Parliament to the elegant sandstone buildings of the Mint itself. The only problem was that the Mickleberg brothers, Brian, Raymond, and Peter, had been framed. They were arrested on July 26. 22-year-old Peter Mickleberg had been talking to Belmont Police Station in Perth's eastern suburbs, where feared cop Don Hancock was waiting for him with his colleague Anthony Lewandowski. The young men would later testify Hancock beat him and made him strip naked, but despite that, he refused to sign a confession to a crime he didn't commit. Mm. So this guy is getting beat up. He's been stripped naked. So the confession, probably been like, your dick's not that big, dude.
The confession was forced out of him, right?
Yeah, so it says it didn't matter. The confession was unsigned. So the confession went on.
We didn't confess.
So it's like if I wrote something being like, by the way, I stole the Perth man.
We're charging you for refusing to sign the confession I typed.
So although unsigned, the so-called confession went on to form a major part of the prosecution's case when Peter, Ray, and Brian went on trial in the Supreme Court the following year for defrauding the Mint. The other key plank supposedly proving the brothers' guilt was the presence of Raymond Mickleberg's fingerprint on one of the checks presented to the Mint. By this time, the police had conducted highly publicized raids on Ray Mickleberg's home that they allowed TV cameras to film. So they went full cops on it. Mm-hmm. And it said it uncovered quantities of gold and silver hidden under the floorboards. So they went into the home, raided it, and there was gold and silver there.
Okay, first we've heard of the silver.
Yeah. So they say, never mind, the gold was not the stolen bullion, and that the brothers had receipts to prove that they had legally purchased the gold and silver.
Why has everyone just got gold over there?
Wild West.
Yeah, Wild West, the 1982 gold rush in Perth. They're always a few years behind in Perth. So they found this gold, and they're like, this is the gold. And they're like, we have receipts for it. It's actually not the gold. And they're like, I don't know about that. But then they look and they realize that the gold is still missing. The police have no idea where the gold is. They say, Never mind that Peter's confession was in fact written by Don Hancock and fellow detective Anthony Lewandowski, and that Raymond's fingerprint was planted by the police. So they're doing the fingerprints, being like, would you mind just putting it on this check for
oh
us?
Oh, my God.
And so there was to be no leniency from the presiding judge once the guilty verdicts were read out, with Justice Des Heenan singling out the fact that the trio had refused to give up the location of the missing gold, probably because they didn't steal it.
Yeah.
Ray Mickleberg got an astonishing 20-year sentence, one of the harshest on record in Australia for property offences, while Peter was given 16 years and Brian 12 years. And police had another ace up their sleeve. During the investigation, they had found a series of incriminating photographs at the home of Brian Pozzi, a friend of Ray Mickleberg, showing the brothers were connected to another gold scandal, the Yellow Rose of Texas scam. So in 1980, a huge nugget of gold weighing more than 11 kilos had supposedly been found near Kalgoorlie by an elderly prospecting couple. In what turned out to be a publicity stunt, TV crews were called to Jandakot Airport, where a light plane piloted by Brian Mickleberg landed, apparently from the goldfields, and the woman who, with her husband, supposedly found the nugget, emerged carrying the huge rock. So Mickleberg, the guy who has been fingered for the crime, drove a plane to pick up this huge gold nugget that these people had apparently found. The nugget was subsequently assessed by the Perth Mint as containing 94% gold and valued at more than $200,000, which I suppose is quite a lot of money now, but like, if someone tells me I found 11 kilos of gold and they were like, man, that's $200,000, I'd be like, got any more back there? You know, fucking thing weighs more than my child. Like, but anyway, name the gold bullion was named the... Not bullion, because it was a big chunk. It was named the Yellow Rose of Texas. The giant bauble was sold to Alan Bond for $350,000. But in an ironic twist, the man who would go on to defraud investors to the tunes of tens of millions was himself duped by the sale. The nugget turned out to have been manufactured by the Mickleberg brothers, Ray and Brian, reportedly to promote an adventure tourism and prospect businessing they were planning to support start. So basically they were like, we've made a gold bullion.
Right.
This is a publicity stunt.
But it is gold, right? They tested it. It was 94% gold.
Was that fraud?
Yeah. It's interesting what happens here. But like, so... basically, the nugget was manufactured, man-made. So when they did subsequent tests, it was valued at less than half of what Alan Bond paid. Mm-hmm. Not only Ray and Brian, but Peter, Brian, and the brother's mother, Peggy Mickleberg, Peggy was a bit in on this too, because she played the part of the elderly prospector emerging from the plane with a nugget. So she was acting a little hard out, and they're all jailed for their role in the caper, though it had little impact on the sentence of those already behind bars. Over the years, the Mickleberg brothers launched multiple appeals against their Perth Mint swindle convictions, and Brian Mickleberg was partially successful. His sentence was cut to 8 months. He was released in 1984, but in a tragic and what some labelled as a suspicious turn of fate, Brian was killed in a plane crash in 1986. Mm. So Ray and Peter are in jail and the gold is still missing. That is until 1989, when in a bombshell development, one of the missing gold bars was sent to a television reporter named Alison Fan with a note that read, "The Mickleburgs are innocent and rotting in jail." So someone sent one of the gold bars.
Interesting.
I was like, by the way.
Expensive stunt. Seriously.
Yeah. Also, like, you know, like, in movies where, like, serial killers get their danders up and are kind of like, hey, by the way, I did this. Mm. They're never like, hey, I killed all these people. This person's innocent. And so I was like, don't you want to hear how clever I am? But they sent a gold bar and were like, hey, these guys didn't do it.
Yeah, and they send like a finger or something, not something worth $80,000.
By transit property, I must have done it.
Yeah.
So anyway, 3 months later, most of the rest of the missing bullion was delivered to the offices of Channel 7 in pelletized form, also with notes suggesting that the Mickleburgs had been framed. The Mint confirmed that these pellets were the missing gold, but the convictions for the Mickleburgs still stood. They didn't let them out. That is, until the story took another dramatic twist following the 2001 mafia-style assassination of the original investigating detective Don Hancock. And
John Hancock.
Yeah.
So
Don
funny.
Hancock.
He was looking for a John Hancock.
Yeah.
From on the confession.
Is that Hancock prospecting? Like, You know, that's... Oh. No, he's a cop, right?
Yeah, he's a cop. I don't think so.
So, okay, they've gone to jail in the mid-80s,
mm-hmm.
and it's not till the early 2000s.
Yeah, so one of them gets off, dies in a plane crash. Then in the late 80s, they start meshing the gold bars to Channel 7, of all people. Yeah. And like, by the way, the Mickelbergs are innocent. Also, check out Family Guy at 10 p.m. And then in 2001, the original investigating detective gets murdered in a mafia-style assassination.
Yeah.
Says Hancock and his bookie mate, Lou Lewis, great name, they died in a fiery explosion as they sat in a car in the Crooked Cop's driveway and the bomb that had been planted underneath exploded. The following year, Hancock's detective offsider, Anthony Lewandowski, made the stunning confession that he and Hancock had in fact fabricated Peter Mickelberg's confession and had continued to lie and fabricate evidence related to the case over the following years. Finally, the brothers had the smoking gun evidence of the innocence they had so long protested, with Lewandowski's revelation ultimately seeing their convictions overturned in 2004. So that's almost 20 years in jail.
They would have got a massive payout, surely, from the government.
Yep. Raymond and Peter Mickelberg went on to be awarded hundreds of thousands of dollars for their wrongful convictions and won an apology from the police in 2007, which I'd be like, maybe double the hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands isn't that much. Like, if you split that down into, like, an annual salary, you know?
Yeah, especially, like, considering... By that point, the gold probably would have been worth close to millions. But it says, in 2016, 34 years after the swindle, they faced another legal battle when Legal Aid threatened to try recover the hundreds of thousands of dollars it cost to defend them. So Legal Aid was like,
they came for them.
Well, you owe us that.
Fucking hell. A Mickelberg. It's tough to be a Mickelberg. That's what I've always said. These guys can't catch a break.
Yeah. Unlike their fight to clear the names, the matter was quickly resolved. So Legal Aid basically withdrew the action. Who was behind the Perth Mint swindle remains a mystery to this day. The brothers' three-decade saga to clear their names and obtain some form of compensation for their ordeal has taken up a large portion of their lives and has gone down in the annals of regrettable Western Australian history. The Perth Mint... Yeah, this last
now needs you to show your ID when you buy it.
Well, the Perth Mint, the last sentence doesn't make any sense in the context of this because the Perth, like, the article was, I think, in the 2000s, the Perth Mint had another scandal. And so, like, it was like, oh, the Perth Mint's just recovered from this. Now they've been fucked over again. Right, but yeah, the two brothers are free. One's dead. One of the cops was assassinated by the mafia, it seems.
Jesus.
But they all fabricated it.
And it's interesting that the guy who did it really didn't end up with any sort of like financial gain because he sent it all fucking to Channel 7.
Which is wild. Like, they're saying like it's still a mystery.
He must have just gone, how do I can't take this down to cash converters. Yeah. Like, what do I do to get rid of this without, and he just sat on it for years and thought, I'm just going to, I don't know. But like, sure, like sending it to trying to get the guys in jail off doesn't help you in that scenario, right? But
also, like, if the Mickelbergs have been framed and you know it and you've got the gold, maybe send it to a lawyer or, like, someone who will do it. Like, obviously sending to police a bad idea because they fabricated the whole thing in the first place. If you send it to the police and be like, the Mickelbergs are wrong, they'd be like, we'll just dump that in an evidence locker and continue being the biggest piece of shit on the planet.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't know. Maybe if I'd stolen
the gold. Sending it to Larry Emder on the Today Show.
Yeah, maybe I'd send it to Daryl Summers.
I got one that's quite similar, unless you want to jump into it. Mine's because it's got some similar themes, actually. Yeah, because this is a story about the Perth character. I call him a character. He's a bit of a wacky lad. The Night Caller. I'll get into it right now. The Night Caller.
I thought you were just slurring your words. I was like, it's Nightcrawler.
No, it's like the Aldi version of the Nightcrawler. They can't call him the same thing. But he's WA's most infamous serial killer, pretty much. So I'll get into it. This is a bit of this jumps around in the telling of the tale, but there's a few elements to this that's really interesting. So first of all, it's a sort of February the 9th, 1963. It's a guy called John Button's 19th birthday. He's very pumped. He's going to spend it. Very, very cute, he's spending it with his 17-year-old girlfriend, which back then was completely fine, by the way.
Jerry Seinfeld style.
Seinfeld was 2 years old. Fucking 20 years old, older. But, yeah, so they were mad. They were madly in love.
I put her on labor.
She's of age. It's legal. So they were madly in love and all this, and he's like, all right, let's spend my birthday together. He jumps into his Simca Aronde P60, which is a French car of the time, apparently, and he drove a short distance to her parents' house, and they spent the day together and all this, and it ended off at the end of the day having a bit of fish and chips at her parents' house with his younger brother, Jimmy. But while they're watching TV, a hand stole a chip from John's plate. He reached and slapped the hand away, thinking it was Jimmy, cursed him out as a thieving bastard, but it was Rosemary's hand. She was very offended, okay? And as some women do, they got a bit emotional. This is literally how it's written.
This is not your commentary?
No. And so she gets upset and
it literally says in the article, as some women do.
A bit it says it's something about young lovers being emotional a bit later on. But she storms off and she says, that's it, I'm walking home. I don't want any more of this. And he goes, come on, get back in the car. I'm sorry. Drives after. She won't get in. So he goes, all right, I'll just let her walk it off and calm down. I'll pull over, have a cigarette, and then I'll go and get her and make sure she gets home. He does that, has a cigarette. As he drives up around the corner to where he saw her walk, he looks down and she's on the ground, pretty much dead. Blood coming out of her head. He freaks out, grabs her, throws her in the car, drives off to the doctors. The doctor's like, she's bleeding out of her head. They go to the hospital. They eventually take her to the hospital. And then the police come in and they get involved. Basically the cops come in and they're a little
cops
bit
like, this looks like a Mickelson job.
The Mickleberry boys.
I know, just go. The three blokes.
So the cops are very suspicious.
Can you put your finger on the murder weapon for me very quickly?
The cops are very suspicious. Okay, first of all, they know about the big fish and chip fight. They hear all about that. So that's motive, right? That's why you want to kill her, because she got mad. They look at the car. There's a dent in the front left bumper of the car. All right. John told him he had a minor accident a couple of weeks ago, but they dismissed that. And there's blood on the front of the car. And he said, yeah, because I just carried my bleeding girlfriend into the car and got a bit of blood on the front of the car. They didn't believe him at all. John had a stutter, and police interpreted his struggle to speak as a nervous behavior. He was also in a state of shock. And when they told him, they came in, they told him that his girlfriend had died and she didn't survive. He vomited everywhere and was a complete,
that's innocent to
complete
me.
Nervous wreck. After 22 hours of interrogation and physical abuse at the hands of the officers, John gave up and signed a written confession, right? So they wrote a confession.
Perth cops.
Yeah.
Let's take them down Comnot style.
22 hours, and apparently
they tortured him.
Barton would claim that the lead detective, John Wiley, punched him in the gut to get the confession. it's a bully. I'm like, confess, like say
how
uncle.
How long do you think you could survive under confession?
23 hours.
23 hours?
I don't know. Like, because the thing
15
is...
15 minutes for me.
Yeah.
So what John was saying, he says is, look, I just wanted to leave. They wouldn't let me leave. I wasn't allowed... no one knew their rights back then.
I bet the room also, like, still had vomit and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Like, and sure. And also, he said he sort of was... He felt so guilty because she was dead and he should have been there. I basically did it. And also, he just signed it to... They said, if you sign this, you can go home. It'll be fine. And in his head, he also said, look, I didn't do it, so I wouldn't get in trouble. I knew I wouldn't get in trouble. I just wanted to leave. Yeah. So he signs it, and then eventually they take him to trial, and they have no evidence apart from the car, obviously. You know, and it is quite coincidental. He was in the scene. He was there. It wasn't. He was, you know, around the corner. But he says the car had the crash from the other week, or whatever. They just dismisses of that. So basically, he's facing execution by hanging, right? That's what he's charged with, murder. So he's sitting there. He's waiting for the jury. The foreman of the jury comes out. He's sitting there. His life's in his hands. And the foreman says, "We find the defendant not guilty." So Button's elated. And then the foreman goes, oh, sorry, I said the wrong thing there. I meant to say guilty, Your Honor.
Wait, he's worse than like La La Land.
Yeah, yeah, literally.
He drew it.
Steve Harvey'd it. Yeah, yeah. He goes, guilty, sorry, yeah. But, I mean, Two of the jurors.
So did it say whether, like, during the trial, like, the judge was like, yeah, it's a forced confession or anything?
This is the 60s. They had no, like, you, yeah. And that's so they were like, why would you sign? Why would you, if you didn't do it? No one can understand this concept, right? So two of the jurors had balked at the murder conviction and convicted him of manslaughter. So he didn't actually get sentenced to murder. He did get convicted of manslaughter. That was the stuff up because the foreman said not guilty murder, guilty manslaughter. So he got 10 years in jail, and he didn't appeal his conviction even though he knew he was innocent because his lawyer said it could go the other way and you might get convicted of murder, right? And you'll be hung.
Yeah,
so just do your 5 to 5 to 10, right? So that happened in 63. Just now, let's just rewind back 4 years earlier. Another girl, Gillian Brewer, heir to the McRobinson chocolate fortune.
Jamie, I'm listening.
Jamie's listening. creator of iconic Australian chocolates, Fredo the Frog.
Oh.
Old Gold. Cherry Ripe.
I call my daughter Fredo the Frog.
I love Cherry Ripe.
She's beautiful.
I love Old Gold. We love it all.
Old Gold. That's what I did every week of Powerball.
So she was asleep, Gillian Brewer. She was
Cherry Ripe. Not very good.
Delicious.
That's worse than any of the crimes we've had so far.
You're a Cherry Ripe booster? No.
I don't know. I'm a whatever the opposite.
You don't rate it? Yeah. Booer. What about Bounty?
Bounty stinks.
I'm more of a Bounty guy.
Yeah, so why would you fucking. Cherry Ripe's the same shit, but just with cherries shoehorned in.
It's not all coconut.
I'm not a big fan. I'm a Turkish Delight guy. If I'm going to go for filled chocolate bars,
caramel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Caramel and Corral is good.
Mm. Yeah. Fredo Frog?
Fredo Frog's the cutest baby I've ever seen.
The chocolate, not the baby.
I cry when I hold Fredo Frogs in my house. My daughter, she's fine.
Yeah, not the great feeling coming out of Fredo at the end of the day when you're changing.
I bite and bite. There's no caramel there.
So anyway, Gillian's in her sleep in her bedroom flat. This is 4 years earlier than all that stuff with Button. And anyway, her boyfriend goes out, comes home the next morning. He's awake. She's dead. She's been killed with a tomahawk.
Ugh.
And a pair of dressmaking scissors. No fingerprints are found in the flat apart from her and her boyfriend, who had an airtight alibi. He was away for the night. Police have no idea. All leads have run dry. 16 months later, 20-year-old Daryl Beamish, who is what used to be called a deaf mute, which is he can't hear or talk vocally. Mm-hmm. He can only sign, was arrested for being some local pedo stuff, which we'll leave to the side. Not great stuff. But anyway, he was arrested for that. While in arraignment, the cops, he noticed that he lived nearby Brewer's house. So he took him to the scene of the crime, asked him if he killed Brewer. Now, they had to get an interpreter, this lady who came and interpreted the sign language. And after initially denying it, he finally agreed, yeah, I killed her, right? And they didn't really, they typed up a letter, he signed it. Now, he wasn't mentally, disabled, but he was back then the deaf and the dumb. They never educated him. So he's very, very poorly educated, right? So he didn't have a lot of very good English or whatever written, or he could write, but it was very, very bad. So he just signed it. He was confused. And also someone noted that he wrote in the dirt, "I killed Lady Cottesloe," which was the suburb Cottesloe of Perth. And at the trial, he got arrested. There was no evidence, no DNA, no fingerprints, nothing linking him to the crime at all. He said he just misinterpreted what the interpreter like said back to him. Mm-hmm. He just signed and went along with it. He didn't really understand. He wrote, "I didn't kill Lady in the dirt. I was trying to tell them I didn't do it. I didn't do it." And the jury found him guilty of willful murder with a strong recommendation to mercy. So the judge sentenced him to death.
Jesus Christ.
So he gets, he's waiting execution.
The justice system in Perth is crazy. Unbelievable. Yeah. The cops being like, "We've got nothing." Death penalty? Yeah. And then the judge being like, "Sure,
let's go with it.
I'm feeling merciful."
Yeah, so anyway, those two guys...
It's giving mercy.
Those two guys are sitting in jail, okay? Both with confessions that they claim were coerced and they don't agree with. 4 years later, this is where it starts to really cook, right? Pun intended, because, sorry.
Oh, God.
Oh, no.
Foreshadowing. I like it.
Foreshadowing. 4 years later, 27th of January, it's Australia Day weekend. It's a Sunday sort of night, and there's a couple in a parked car in Cottesloe. They notice the deranged man walking around with a rifle, okay? He notices them. He aims and just shoots at them in their car. The woman, just as he pulls the rifle up, pushes her boyfriend's head down in the car.
Classic move.
Well, he said, yeah. She's like, oh, you love doing this to me. So he pushes his head down. The bullet.
No, babe, I'm saving your life.
She pushes his head down. It goes through the shot goes through his neck and her arm, but they're both okay, and they both just get into drive off. Right, yeah. The man after he does that, this of absolutely nothing spurred that on at all. He continues walking. He climbs up on the balcony of a unit. A man called Brian Weir, 29-year-old accountant, is asleep through his bedroom window. The right guy with the rifle shoots him, bang, and he dies from his injuries. He gets in his car, this man, drives to the nearby Netherlands, finds a man sleeping on a veranda, shoots him in the head while he sleeps. He then walks to the next street, rings a random doorbell, 54-year-old George Walmsley opens the door, and the gunman shoots him in the head.
Fuck, dead.
The cops are like, what the fuck is this? Three people shot, three dead, five people shot, three people die in one night within half an hour, all with the same rifle, all clearly the same man. They fingerprint more than 30,000 males over age of 12, and they check more than, this is blew my mind, this is the 60s. They checked more than 60,000 .22 rifles. So there was 60,000 of this particular rifle floating around Perth.
Far out.
Which is, you just forget about Australia before the gun buyback stuff. Yeah. So because they could find 30,000 men and they could find 60,000 rifles of this particular type of rifle, right? So they test fired them, didn't find a single one that matched. And then 2 weeks later, Constance Lucy Madrill, 24, found strangled to death in a flat in West Perth. Different cause of death, but the nearby location, the timing drew curiosity from the cops. 6 months later, Shirley McLeod, 18, found dead in her apartment, shot with a .22 rifle. And they're like, this is definitely the same guy. The cops get a break, though, because someone finds a .22 rifle stashed in the bush in Mount Pleasant across the river. So the cops test the gun, and it is the murder weapon for the shootings. So what they do is they disable the gun, and in a very like cartoon Looney Tunes style, they put it back in the bush, but they tie a fishing line to it.
Oh my god!
Run it around the bush, around the corner, and they sit there like they're trying to. You know,
on a tree, they planted a big black tunnel. Yeah. Right into.
Went to the Wile E. Coyote School of Police.
Yeah, so, it's all Acme evidence based.
So they eventually they wait for 18 days and some decent policing. They sit there and they wait. They assume he might come back for it. And a man comes 17 days later, a man comes, picks it out of the bush, Eric Edgar Cook. Right? That's where he starts cooking, exactly. Right? There we go. Yeah, okay. Right.
So leisurely. You'd think he was going to kill Cook and eat someone.
Well, that comes a little later on. So Edgar Cook, he picks up the gun and they go, bang, we got our guy. So Edgar Cook, it's just the same. Every single crazy serial killer, it's the same. Unhappy, violent family. Dad bashed him. Mother was getting bashed, the alcoholic dad, ran away from home. Like, it's just just the most typical stuff all the time. He starts doing break and enters as a teen. He serves 80 months in jail for burning down a church after he was rejected from the choir, which is a great reaction to that.
I was going
to
say,
a few rejections from the store.
So death metal to burn down a church, but you find out the reason. Choir boy.
Because his little choir voice wasn't good enough. So he's arrested for break and enters, and the cops explain how they caught him with all these fingerprints and all these break and enters. So he learns about fingerprinting and how, because this is before true crime, right? Yeah. So people didn't understand this stuff back then. So they got him, and in his detailed confessions, Cook admitted over the course of, his sort of criminal career to over 250 break-ins and burglaries with remarkable detail. He even says that in the 60s, people often felt secure enough to leave their keys in cars' ignition overnight. Eric Edgar Cook took advantage of this almost every night. He stole a car, drove it around, committed crimes, and only to return it in the morning before the owner even realized it was gone. Right? Jeez. He offered up 22 violent crimes to police, including 8 murders, 14 attempted killings, including the murders of Rosemary Anderson and Gillian Brewer.
Oh wow!
So he said, "I did it." He said he got caught. He got a lady called Patricia Berkman was 33. He was robbing a house. She came in and found him. He stabbed her to death. And then he obviously got a thrill out of that. And he went on a murder spree over the next 5 to 6 years. And Gillian, he would just drive around. He saw Gillian Brewer one night.
So the original woman didn't break into a house. Was just like, she'll do.
This is the thing with Cook, which blows everyone's mind, is he killed 8 people and tried to kill him. And just like completely random so many different, yeah, like a lot of them.
That's what I was going to say, is he has no MO.
No, absolutely no MO. Well, apart from shooting people asleep, which he did for like half his murders, but the rest of them, strangling, like stabbing, it's crazy. Yeah, exactly. Hit and run.
And it's crazy to be a, like a serial killer, but also just pop a spree kill in the middle. Yeah, like that's so incongruous.
And years between. So he killed a couple of people, then he went on the spree, then he killed a couple more 6 months later. Incredibly not typical at all. So the cops say, look, this is how the cops treat. Like they're punching this other guy to admit. They're like, Cookie, come on, mate, you're going to hang, you know that. So like they're treating him like a buddy.
Got his arm around
him. Yeah, like, come on, mate, Cookie. You and me go back ages. You got a wife, and so you had a wife and kid this whole time, by the way. You got to think about, you know, you're going to be dragged to the gallows like a mongrel dog. Are you going to go there like a man? Admit everything you've done. So he does.
That's a cool interrogation technique. Dude, are you a bitch?
Admit
to the killing.
Mongrel dog. So he says, I did it all, right? He's sentenced to hang and he is hung, but as he's led to the gallows, he knows that these other two guys are still in jail at the time for these murders. One of them's going to get out.
So deaf mute guy's still in jail.
Both are still in jail.
But so that's wild, right? Like, as soon as he confesses, he's been led to the gallows. They haven't made any kind of effort to get rid of the two guys who are innocent.
So as he's been led to the gallows, he swears on a Bible from a minister, I swear before Almighty God that I killed Anderson and Brewer. The reverend who he does that in front of, literally 30 seconds before he gets walked across, he does a stat deck. This is what he said. He told the cops where to find the car that he used in the hit and run. He said, that hit and run, I drove it over this part of the park. I smashed it. I drove it into a tree to disguise the hit and run. And then I left it. And that the owners, when they found it, they said, yep, that all matches up. And that wasn't a reported stolen car. Yeah. He also explained how he killed the woman. And there was details that only he would know about her, where like her frying pan and all this sort of stuff. All this information the cops got. Then the Button and Beamish both appealed, obviously. And in both cases, the judges were like, nah, don't care. He's a murderer. And they used all his depraved actions against his testimony. They said, he's a depraved killer. We can't trust him.
Oh, my God. So that is lunacy.
Yes, absolutely. So basically, they just sort of – and there was some discrepancies, but like stuff that was just – he just clearly confused one murder that he did with another.
Yeah.
But you put a guy to death for the two fucking murders. Yeah. I'm mad.
Yeah, so Button gets –
you gotta start legally.
So eventually Beamish gets commuted. What do you call it? Paroled. So neither of them – so Button serves 5 years in prison, 5 years parole. He's a hit-and-run guy who got charged. Beamish gets 10 years, and eventually we can't hang a deaf mute guy based on this evidence. So
he was also innocent.
Yeah, so they give him 10, I think they give him 15 years. He does his 15 years and then he is released. But they're still both murderers in the eyes of the law. Yeah, so they're out of jail now. So they do the original appeal when they're in jail, dismissed out of hand. They're just living their life, but they're convicted murderers for 20 years. And all the lawyers and all the legal scholars in this town know that it's bullshit. Or at least they've got suspicions it's bullshit. And then 1998, right? So we're talking 30 years later, Western Australian journalist Estelle Blackburn basically writes a book on it called Broken Lives. And she goes into real detail and she gets a bunch of lawyers and they fly out a pedestrian crash expert, William Rusty Haig from the United States, to perform a test on the car the Button drove versus the car that Cook claimed he drove. Because one of the things the judge dismissed was that car couldn't have done that. It's got a steel sun visor, and that would have a dent in it, and it doesn't. Like, these real technical things the judge was hung up on.
Mm. Always good to have a jet fuel doesn't melt steel.
It literally was that. So the judge was like, come on, this is sun visor. That would have a dent in it. He's still in jail. The guy does, like, Mythbuster style, like, crash test dummy stuff, drives both cars. They have to find this French car from the 60s. They get three versions of it. They drive it. It's all completely aligned with like the damage to the French car, the Button's car, was like on the front light, and this woman went over the bonnet, and the other car had all this other damage, so that it was completely consistent, or at the very least prove that it couldn't have been Button's car. And they do a bunch of other information, and eventually in 2002 the Court Criminal Appeals quashed Button's conviction, right?
Jeez.
2002. So when that happens, Beamish is, he's against, they're both still alive. He finds out, he's like, well, okay, based on, he confessed to that, He confessed to this. Why would he lie to that and that to this? He goes to the confessions, and they eventually, in 2005, they squash Beamish's appeal based on that. The Western Australian government gives them both around $400,000 each as part of the wrongful thing. Very similar amount to old mate, right? But apparently, again, just like legal aid came clawing, apparently when they gave it to... So 400 grand for a button, which was 10 years in jail and 30 years of being a pariah in the community.
Mm.
The woman's family still say he did it, right? So he spent 30 years like that. 400 grand, and he said apparently when that happened, Centrelink knocked our pension back 800 a month.
So the family of the original guy all think that boyfriend did it, even though the original argument was about a chip.
The family of the woman who was killed in the hit and run still think the boyfriend did it.
But the argument started over a French fry.
Yes,
French fry.
Correct. Yeah.
And so they're like, he's the exact kind of guy.
Yeah. Who, but Jamie, what you're forgetting is that he does stutter.
So, yeah.
Who's to say?
Exactly. They're just so hung up on the, why would you say you did it if you didn't do it? And they can't wrap their head around that. So, yeah, that to this day,
that's,
he's still a pariah.
That's insane. Like,
people
get false confessions from torture all the time. Yeah. It's the easiest thing to wrap your head around.
Unbelievable stuff. So, there you go. Right. So that's,
I like the deaf mute guy as well, finally getting out and being like, now I can resume my pedophilia.
It's so funny because no one talks about why he was originally arrested in all the articles.
Because I kept being like, oh man, that poor deaf mute guy. Yeah. And I was like, wait a minute.
I was so upset when I found that out. Because, like, why was he originally arrested? And no one says it in one article. They're like, he was arrested for fiddling. I'm like, fuck. Beamish.
Beamish.
Anyway.
All right. I got a bit of a forgotten tale from the 80s in Perth that sort of came to light a little bit recently because the son of one of the people involved ended up investigating it and working with the ABC to do this big sort of four-corner style report into this. So strap in. I'll set the scene. The story starts September 1st. 1988, Perth, WA. I've Had the Time of My Life by Bill Medley and Jennifer Warnensmost from the Dirty Dancing soundtrack, number one on the ARIA charts. So, you know.
Remember training for my formal with that dance at PE. They made us do that.
Really? Oh, yeah. That was your formal song?
Well, I didn't choose it, but like they,
I think Rocky
and Year 10 for like 3 weeks, we did an intensive like dancing, and that was one of the
like waltzy stuff.
Well, it was that, but like I guess the original didn't have like a techno remix part to it, so it's like not like the Black Eyed Peas version, but like some middle ground where like it went off a little bit. But yeah, we had to learn kind of like ballroom-ish crumping.
Ballroom crumping. That sounds like another Black Eyed Peas song.
Yeah.
So that's number one on the ARIA charts. 3,700 kilometers away. Well, 1-year-old Drew Bensley was probably shitting his naps. And
37 years later, an adult Drew Bensley knocks on Sam Bowden's door and is like, I shit my nappy.
And just before dawn, while most of the city's asleep, two men pull into the car park in the suburb of Karawara and approach the Man Lin Chinese restaurant, then douse the exterior in petrol. Set it alight. Completely guts it. Shatters the rear window, melts all the Chinese lanterns and stuff. You can imagine a Chinese restaurant in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Shit's going up pretty
quick. You can imagine a Chinese restaurant today. Yeah, exactly the same.
Exactly. So it completely fucks it. And it's kind of a cool building. And it's very... So the people who built it wanted to do it in, like, you know, the Cantonese, like, the architecture with the curved roof and stuff. Mm-hmm. It looked really cool-looking building.
Mm-hmm.
Later that morning, very same morning, September 1, 88, a second Chinese restaurant is targeted, kicking off what would become a coordinated campaign of terror on the streets of Perth. So the man
never fall for long after Chinese, right? Yeah, you bomb one, and it's like very quickly after, you're like, oh, gotta bomb another one.
All that MSG. So the Man Lin was owned by the Chan family. They'd moved to Australia in the 60s, and they had worked at several other restaurants before finally scrounging together some money, opening their own restaurant. And then so the cop who's sort of leading the arson squad, this is a bloke named Maury Tong. He suspected it was targeted straight away. You know, two Chinese. He's like, yeah, I think it's probably right.
So the one decent cop in Perth makes the easiest logical conclusion you can make.
Everyone, every other cop's like, I got this paraplegic guy over here that we're going to just headbutt until he signs.
Probably the Mickelberg brothers and this deaf mute guy. It's
deaf mute Mickelberg.
There were no strong leads, basically. Like the evidence, there's just no evidence. But it was confirmed that it was targeted a couple of months later in November 1988 when a Molotov cocktail was launched at the Golden House Chinese restaurant in Bellevue. Then in the new year, in 89, there was an attempt to torch the Kosing Chinese restaurant in Ferndale and then the Lingnan Chinese restaurant in Mirabooka only a few days after that. While this is going on, unbeknownst to the police, the gang had also committed more than 15 burglaries across Perth, helping them fund their activities. So they were robbing places at night, using that to make these, you know, get the petrol, get the bombs, plan it all, right?
You'd be shitting yourself if you're a Chinese restaurant in Perth at that time, right?
Like,
yeah, well, exactly right. This is, it's kind of interesting because the guy who sort of brought this up all these years later, the son of the Chan family, his name's Crispian, and he'd be in his 40s now, but he was just a little kid, like, and he remembers being like, he's got all these like interesting memories because he was just like, well, he never felt like he was in danger. But then looking back, he's like, well, fuck, we were getting targeted because his parents are, you know, trying to protect him a little bit. But, and he just doesn't really know what's going on. He's just like, what's going on? Why is the place burnt down? So suspicions soon fall on a group that were pretty well known to police at the time. It was a racist neo-Nazi group called the Australian Nationalist Movement. Their leader was a bloke named Peter Joseph, known as Jack Van Tongeren, a short man with a mustache and jet black hair.
Interesting.
What was Drew Bensley up to again? Is that your alibi? He's trying to get in earlier.
Yeah, that's why you brought it up right at the start. Well, I couldn't have done it. I was shitting my pants.
Perth cop's like, no. You know, he may be a one-year-old child. But
can you put your finger in the stifle, please?
So what had been happening from about 1987, the ANM, that's the Australian Nationalist Movement, they've been plastering racist propaganda all over bus stops, lampposts, road signs, all over the city. Black and white posters with racist caricatures and slogans such as Asians out or racial war.
So they should have looked at the Silver Service guy.
Totally. And white revolution, the only solution.
I'm not going to try to get in these racist heads, but of all the things, of all the Chinese institutions to get rid of, it's
the
like
most beloved one.
Your most beloved one. Yeah, it's exactly. Like, this is the weirdest thing to talk.
And basically during this time, the police did sort of nothing. And, you know, obviously there are a lot of parallels with right now when there's, you know, all these groups, especially in Melbourne, putting up all these like hateful signs and spreading, you know, using this sort of like evil rhetoric and stuff. But the police are completely ignoring it. But also there's just no law. There was no law that prohibited putting up racist posters.
Yeah.
There was a law that was just against putting up posters on public property. That's all they had to go on.
Yeah, right.
You can't advertise heavily comedy.
Yeah.
It's also probably like 2 degrees separated from what like One Nation at the, whatever the One Nation at the time was saying publicly. Oh, totally, like, you know, whatever.
Well, that's what a lot of people, you know, in the story were saying. Like, there is a lot of that where it was like, you know, oh yeah, sure, the police were saying that, but some of the cops were expressing sentiments that were pretty similar to this. This is 80s Australia, pretty, and Western Australia too.
Which is like 60s Australia.
So Maury Tong, this bloke, he's the head of the arson squad. He knew that that it was like obviously a deliberately lit fire because it's a restaurant. Restaurants sometimes burn, you know, kitchens got fire. So he was like, this is arson. But again, the evidence of the scene was pretty thin. That was up until 1989 when the group returned to the Kosing Chinese restaurant in Ferndale, which, if you recall, that's one they attempted but failed to burn. That was just one of their sort of spree in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So, unlike the previous attacks, this time the group came armed with something a bit more sinister, and that was a mining explosive wrapped in fencing wire, and they blew the fucking roof off the place. Like, this is a full-on bomb. Windows shattered out into the street. Massive escalation from throwing Molotov cocktails.
Were people getting killed during this, or is it just property damage?
Just property damage.
Well, that's okay.
That's the end.
Come on, slap on the wrist then.
So then, cue Operation Jackhammer. A senior member of the A&M by the name of Russell Wiley had been picked up for a string of burglaries, and he was facing decades in prison, so he turned snitch, wore a wire, went back undercover for a couple of weeks.
Russell Wiley.
Yeah. Ended up catching...
Did you just mention a guy called Wiley as well?
No.
Wiley J?
Wiley I... Wiley,
well, that's why... Wiley J.
Yeah, yeah. Wiley Coyote.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Did you mention a guy called Roadrunner?
He ended up catching hours of taped conversation, proving to A&M... Like, these guys... could not stop blabbing to each other. They're sitting around like bragging about the bomb, you know, all the fires and stuff. They raid a rural property an hour north of
Perth.
Bragging
about the bomb. There's a joke there to be one of my favorite topics.
Oh, downplaying it. At first they were bragging, then like, wasn't that bad.
Actually, it was the best bombing ever.
It was pretty good.
They raided a property an hour north of Perth that the gang was using for paramilitary style training. And there police found an underground bunker lined with sandbags, a firing range, lookout tower, buried weapons, and more than $10,000 cash.
No way.
And there were some photos that I saw of this, and it looks like the lair in an 80s action movie where they're all training, yeah. Right? Like it's full on.
Foot Clan.
Exactly. So after that arrest, two other members of the A&M suspected this other bloke, David Locke, that he was the snitch. So Wiley got away scot-free. Poor old Locke, he copped it. They lured him into a park in the suburb of Gosnells where he was beaten with iron bars and had his throat slit.
Oh,
so they get rid of him.
Dead.
In 1990, Jack Van Tongeren and a couple of others were convicted of over 150 offences. And so when we have guests and they leave, it's less weird than when Jamie just leaves. I'm just telling you a story from my phone. Yeah, all right. So that's Jamie piss count number two. So where was I? It's Van Tongeren and a few others. They were convicted of over 150 offences. This is in 1990. Van Tongeren is sentenced to 18 years jail, but he only ends up serving 12. And was released on parole in the early 2000s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so through 2002, he's released. And wouldn't you know it, a few months after he gets out, Chinese restaurants around Perth mysteriously start going up in flames.
Unbelievable. I mean, what is the, like, long-term plan here?
He's a racist who wants to intimidate the Chinese population. I guess in his mind, he's like, they'll all... What, fly back to China?
That's what I'm trying to... I can sort of see these idiots in the 80s seeing a bunch of Rambo movies and being like, yeah, we should fucking... But surely you'd bomb a few of them and then you go to jail for 20 years and then you go, fuck, I was a dumb idiot.
Not with Perth cops, though, where the job application is like, are you a bloke? Like, go for it.
I guess so.
So then, while the restaurants are burning again, a bunch of racist graffiti attacks on Asian businesses start occurring. He denies it all.
And how old are you at this point?
At this point, I would have been 15 years old.
No longer shitting into a nappy.
Yeah, although, look, I've never been to Perth, allegedly. Four people were convicted for the attacks on three restaurants. These are the modern ones. And although police found A&M propaganda at one of their houses, that still wasn't enough to say A&M were responsible. So, it's the most obvious thing in the world, but just for whatever reason, in a court of law, it doesn't quite add up. The chain of evidence, whatever, it breaks down somewhere. But police at the time were sensibly, for once, monitoring Van Tongeren during this time. And they found that his gang had hatched a separate plot to bomb four other restaurants, including the Manlin, which had reopened. And that was the very first one to burn. In August 2004, a week-long manhunt, this detail I loved, A week-long manhunt for Van Tongeren ended with police receiving a tip-off that located him at an RSL club.
He's at the result. Definitely was not playing Lucky 88. Yeah, yeah. Would not be seen playing a machine like that. You want to play a good Aussie machine. Yeah, like, where's the gold?
All those Dragon Cash ones, he'd be fucking steaming. This time he's given a two-year suspended sentence and ordered to leave WA.
Just dump him on us over here.
Yeah. And then obviously, you know, mysteriously the attacks cease the second he's gone. So he fucking did it. And there's kind of a semi, you know, happy ending, at least for the man Lin, because they did reopen and they became bigger than ever. So the Chans ran it for 20 years, retired in 2008, closed the doors. And they said, sort of, you know, there was such an awesome, like, outpouring from the community. Support. The second it opened, it was, they were like, dude, we'll run off our feet for years, right? Mm-hmm. So everyone loved them. Then, as I mentioned, the 30th of September 2023, Crispian Chan, his ethnic Chinese resident of Perth, whose family restaurant had been bombed by the A&M in the 80s, he published an article for the ABC about how he attempted to track Van Tongeren down, discovered that he was living in South Australia to this day, and I did a little extra research, and apparently he's
through the bounty hunter.
He's, well, yeah, I got that dog in. He's apparently working as a portrait artist.
That's unbelievable.
He just paints people's portraits. And I looked up some of the portraits that he's done, and
racial caricatures.
Well, one of them was a German Australian fella who was Australia's most prominent Holocaust denier.
Fucking hell.
He painted him with big, huge muscles. Yeah. Superman, yeah, on, like, Mount Olympus.
One of those Trump paintings that you see. Yeah, yeah. The biggest dick you've ever seen. Two AK-47s.
And while Crispian is trying to track him down for this article, he gets threatened by an associate of Van Tongeren's to, like, back off, you know. And in his article, he sort of goes into Van Tongeren, which is kind of, there's like a psychologically odd, interesting thing going on here, right? So, Peter Joseph Van Tongeren, Jack, he was born in the Netherlands, Jamie Kirk, so I might just deflect a little of blame onto you on this one.
I wasn't born in the Netherlands.
He was born in 1947 to a Dutch father and Australian mother. The family later migrated to Australia. He joined the Australian Army, saw action in Vietnam in the 70s. Following his military service.
He did see action in Vietnam. That's his train. I was a tunnel rat.
Following his military service, he travelled throughout Australia from 79 to 83. He associated with a variety of far-right groups, such as the South Australian League of Rights, the Tasmanian branch of the Anglo-Saxon Celtic Society, Sydney-based National Action Neo-Nazi Group, and the Los Angeles-based Neo-Nazi American Workers' Party.
That's wild, because, like, the Netherlands was, like, one of the most persecuted places in the Second World War. Yeah. Like, I mean, like, Anne Frank is the most, one of the most famous examples.
Yeah, yeah.
While he was in Sydney, he ran for the Senate with the Nazi group, the National Action, and he got a whopping 1,077 votes.
That's too many.
0.13%.
That's way too many.
He left in 85. He left that group. He went back to Perth and formed the A&M. That was in 1985, so 3 years before this campaign started. But just to add a little extra layer, you know, you mentioned he's this neo-Nazi, he's a Netherlands background. In the 90s sometime, it came out that his father was part Javanese. So he's a quarter Indonesian.
Right.
He's an Asian dude.
And, like, he knew it wasn't, like, a mystery to him.
No, he knew. Yeah.
Wow.
And so
he's not doing 23andMe being like, fuck.
Yeah. So Crispian Chan, who did this article, tried to track him down. He kind of made an interesting comparison between the two of themselves, because they both have shared Asian heritage. And according to Van Tongeren's mother, who wrote an article about, like, what the fuck happened to my son, she, you know, she's not racist or anything, she very much disavowed him, but she wrote this big article that was kind of like, he as a kid has suffered horrific racist bullying for being Asian.
That'll do it.
And so it's this weird, and, like, self-hating, then he goes to Vietnam, this tweaks, like, something. So
I always wonder how people go far right. And, like, that's got to be one of the ways.
So. Yeah.
It's the same as those Republican, I don't know, I feel like there's a bunch of them where we're, like, clearly game.
Exactly. There's a lot of projection.
Extremely homophobic. Yeah. It's got to be a similar thing.
But yeah, so that's...
What do you mean a new bathhouse is open?
I better go down and check it out.
Because I will shut it down from the inside.
So yeah, that's just a little known period of Australian history that you don't hear too much about. Pretty much a terrorist campaign over several years. Yeah,
I would love to do another one on Perth because I found like at least two more things. I think
enough cooking in Perth for sure.
Yeah,
definitely. I think we scratched the surface.
That's great. Yeah. Fun,
all right.
Awesome. Good time.
Well,
too.
If you like that, guess what, baby? We have a Patreon for $5 a month, you can get 2 bonus episodes a month. That's right. 2 bonus episodes with the boys.
Oh, yeah.
Griffin. Sometimes we'll have a guest. We're doing an oral history of Sydney comedy. Yeah, that's
all catching on. Stop trying to get Cheeky 3 to work.
You've been trying to happen. You've been trying to Cheeky 3 since before the podcast. Different context, but
you had a Cheeky 3 before the podcast.
I did have a Cheeky 3 before the podcast. 3 inches. And so we've got a lot of episodes that are coming out. News offcuts, more research, deep dives. It's got everything you'd want and more. And it only costs $5, baby. You can keep listening to the free pod. We're more than 160 episodes in. Mm-hmm. We're going to do this forever. There is no way our friendship could break up. There is no way this podcast could break up. You guys are awesome. Please keep getting in touch with us via Instagram. We love hearing from you. We love your stories. We love your memes. We love everything you guys do. You can also get merchandise from the link in our Instagram bio. You can get a t-shirt. It's summer, baby. Cut those arms off.
We should wear a fucking singlet.
Let's do it.
I was thinking of the worst community notice board shirt the other day, which was just like a penis like being hit with a hammer that says CNB. CNB torture.
That's good.
Yeah. I was like, that's so funny. Or no one will buy it.
CNB torture, one of our listeners listening to our thing.
Actually, that might if you're a local artist, it could do someone like going crazy listening to us.
I've heard that cops use this podcast to force confessions out of people.
I did it. I'll sign anything.
He's in Gitmo. And if you're a Western Australia cop, do better. Apart from that, we will see you next week for the Red Hot episode. See you later.
Bye.